everybody, and welcome to another episode of UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week we introduce a new subject about UFOs or the paranormal. And tonight, our guest is Helen Littrell. That's L-I-T-T-R-E-L-L. And she is the author of the book, Rachel's Eyes, The Strange But True Case of a Human-Alien Hybrid. Now, before I actually introduce our guest and start talking about this amazing, amazing book, I just thought I'd give you guys a little background about human-alien hybrids. Now, I've been doing research in the UFO phenomena for just about 20 years now, and the human-alien hybrid story pretty much broke right when I got involved in UFO research in the late 1980s. This is when Bud Hopkins released his book, Intruders, which pretty much showed that one of the main alien agendas, if you will, appears to be the alien-human hybrid project. Now, this has turned up in a lot of cases. It's funny, when that book came out, I actually just uncovered my own first case involving a family who was having experiences, and the daughter was taken on board a craft several times. Then later, the mother was taken on board and shown babies. She was told to hold them and love them. She said each of these babies were deformed. Some had very large heads. Some were just not right at all. But the lady on the UFO told her that they had everything, but they didn't have love. They needed nurturing, which seems to be a common theme among these alien-human hybrids. But as the years went on, we started hearing more and more about these alien-human hybrids. Dr. Jacobs, David Jacobs, his second book, the first is Secret Life, the other one is called The Threat. And he writes about these alien hybrids actually visiting Earth and living on our planet for extended periods of time. Now, this may sound incredible, but these kinds of stories are really beginning to add up to a huge number. For example, John Hunter Gray, he is a social worker in the Midwest, and he had an abduction experience in Wisconsin. And he talked about how prior to his abduction experience, he stopped off at a gas station with his son, and there he saw a strange, short, little man watching him. This was at the gas station. The man was dressed up in all these heavy clothes and had big dark sunglasses on, obviously hiding his appearance. And he, John Hunter Gray, believes this was actually one of the ETs staking out the abduction before it happened. And apparently this is not unusual. Shane Kurz, she was an abductee in New York. Prior to her being abducted, she was visited by this strange-looking fellow at her school who tried to lure her into the field behind the school. He was a human-looking, but odd-looking. He was dressed strangely. He had very white, pasty skin, very large eyes, but otherwise looked normal. And she refused, obviously, to go follow this guy. Later, she saw another very strange-looking guy in the liquor store. And this was all prior to her abduction, and once she was abducted, she underwent hypnosis, and she saw these people actually on board the UFO. So the point I'm trying to make is that there are alien hybrids among us walking among our population undetected. And I know how this may sound to some of you, but there's a lot of stories like this. Whitley Strieber, he published the book Communion, which tells his stories in upstate New York of abductions. Well, right when the book was released, Whitley Strieber's publisher went to the bookstore in New York City to see how the book was doing. Well, he walked into the bookstore, and who was at the shelf but these strange-looking figures? They were wearing overcoats. They had big, dark glasses on, large hats. They were obviously hiding their appearance. He walked up to them, and that's when he had a really strange encounter, which actually Whitley wrote extensively about. And he believes they were aliens or hybrids or possibly one or the other. Hard to say. But this is the point I'm trying to make, is that these experiences are happening, and this is why I'm really, really excited about our guest tonight, Helen Littrell. Now, tonight's topic is Rachel's Eyes, The True Story of a Human-Alien Hybrid. This is a book that's been written by Helen Littrell. Now, I think that, as I've said, we've discovered that this is one of the main agendas behind the UFO presence. And if you're skeptical about this, I mean, wait till you hear what tonight's guest, Helen Littrell, has to say. Now, Rachel's Eyes is actually the story of Helen's daughter, Marissa, and her odd college roommate, Rachel. They were two young women who didn't really fit in. One was legally blind and needing assistance, and the other had a very strange diet and seemingly no history at all. As it turned out, Helen's daughter's roommate was apparently a human-alien hybrid, part of an apparent government experiment to see if hybrids could live among us. Now, this is a true story, and it's astounding. Now, Helen Littrell operates a home-based medical transcription business. She is also a freelance editor and a consultant for a major publisher and has written 6 books on medical specialties and terminology. Now, she currently lives in Southern Oregon, and her book, Rachel's Eyes, is published by Wildflower Press. So, Helen, thank you for coming onto the show.
Well, thank you, Preston, for inviting me on.
No, it's my honor, believe me. And I also want to thank you for being brave enough to tell your story. I mean, this is really an astounding story, and I think a lot of people are probably going through this and haven't come forward.
A lot of people have undergone similar experiences, and to some degree, maybe not quite of the extent that I did, but a lot of people have been undergoing situations like this for several years, and some of them have never been able to talk about it. And that's really a shame, because they need to talk. They're carrying a terrible burden around. You know, they feel guilty or they're afraid to talk for fear they might lose their jobs or be ostracized by their family or friends and everything. And I felt some of those concerns, too.
I would imagine, yeah.
Yes. But finally, I decided it really didn't matter. I needed to tell a story, and I had found out that my job was going to be abolished anyway. So there went that major concern about my income. And then I talked to my sons, to see what their feeling was, because they would ultimately be, well, involved. You know, their names would be made public, too.
Sure.
And they said, just go for it, Mom.
Wow.
Go for it. And my one boy said, own your work. And I thought, first that was a strange thing to say, but not really. After I thought it over a little bit, own your work. You should. If something like this had, you know, happens to other people, as it did to me, then step up to the plate and acknowledge it.
Yeah, I think it's great that you did. I mean, it's amazing that you did.
Well, I've had my moments, you know, when I thought, oh, I should never have done that, but I am very happy that I did now. And
well, have you had any negative impact from that?
Not really. I have had my phone tapped and my computer hacked into, and I've had some intimidation visits by some people, I thought they were people at the time, but thinking about it for a few months, it seemed that they were more like androids or something. They were dressed in military uniforms, supposedly like fatigues, and driving a supposedly normal-looking vehicle, but there were quite a few things wrong with their uniform, and there were several wrong, really noticeable, with their vehicle that led me to believe that, they were here to intimidate me. I'm sure of that. I'm not still exactly sure where they came from, but
you know, that sounds like the classic Men in Black.
It does. It does. They weren't dressed like that, but their attitude was the same. A very, very cold looking, and no expression on their faces, and just staring.
Did they say anything?
No, they didn't. How it happened was that they had pulled into a neighbor's driveway right beside my lawn, and they had parked there exactly in the spot where they could look into my kitchen window. And how they knew that I would be looking out of the window, I have no idea. But it was about 8:30 one morning, and my son was living with me at the time, and we both got up to go over by the window to get a cup of coffee. And as we did, we looked out the window, and here were these guys sitting in supposedly a military van. But there was just something off about them to begin with. Things just weren't right. They didn't look right. The vehicle certainly wasn't. And that staring in was really frightening at first for me. It continued to be the whole time they were sitting there for my son. He was just really, really terrified. He's an adult. He wasn't a little kid. But as I say, I was really afraid for a few minutes. And then it made me angry because it dawned on me what they were there for, because it was at a time when I didn't know whether I was going to go forward with finishing up the book and having it published or not. I had come to sort of a dead end in investigations, and I thought, well, maybe I should just let it go. But, that visit convinced me that I should just go ahead with it.
Right.
If they went to that much trouble to come and intimidate me, then I know that the story was true. I knew it right from the first. But that just clinched it for me that they would go to that much trouble to come and put on a display like that. I knew then that I really did have to go ahead with it.
Wow. So how did this all start?
Getting the story together to write, or
no? I mean the actual story itself. I mean.
Oh, it started back in 1972 when my daughter had moved out of the home suddenly, and she was a freshman in a junior college, and she had a little income, not very much. It was like a disability or Social Security because she was legally blind. But it wasn't enough money to live on by herself. And so the counselor at this junior college helped her get situated in the apartment, loaned her some money of her own, and volunteered to get her someone suitable to live with her. And within a couple of days, this strange person turned up in the counselor's office, and she was looking for a situation where she could live with someone who wouldn't be too critical of her, because as she and her father said, who was an Air Force colonel, he said her ways were just a little bit different, and she might need more time to study, and he was willing to pay more than half the rent and the utilities and everything. And it turned out that the two girls began living together almost immediately.
Wow. That sounds like a perfect living situation. They can each help each other, right?
She, as I said, she was looking for someone who wouldn't be too critical of her appearance, and my daughter was legally blind, so, that was not a problem. She couldn't see very much. Actually, she couldn't see hardly at all to get around. So in that respect, it was really perfect. But for both of them, as I look back on it now, I think it was set up by the government.
Right.
Because this girl, this Rachel, she did turn out to be a part of the humanization project.
Right. Well, there was a number of really strange things about her that your daughter noticed right off the bat.
Yes. For one thing, and I think you mentioned it at the beginning, she could only eat a certain substance, which was not regular food at all. She was not allowed to eat anything. And you know how college kids did, especially back in the 70s. It was pizza and and a lot of junk food. Well, it still is, but at any rate, she couldn't eat anything except this food that came, or substance, I called it. It came in little white boxes, like frozen food used to come in, like peas and corn and things like that. They used to come in little white square boxes, and that's what her food came in, and she couldn't drink regular water or soda or milk or anything like that. Her liquid to drink arrived in great big jugs, similar to the water jug, like spring water jugs that we see nowadays. And these items were delivered outside the apartment door, sort of mysteriously too, at just about the time she was going to run out of her current supply. And then finally, we discovered, or we saw some of the men who brought that food and liquid, and they were what we would call now men in black.
Wow. Huh.
They were sort of oddly built. They were really stocky, and well, they were neither short nor tall. I guess they were probably about 5'10", something like that. But they dressed in real tight-fitting black suits and the big hats. You mentioned that, too. But that's what they wore, too, and dark sunglasses. They were just really odd people.
Huh. Wow. Now, did Rachel say why she had to eat that food? Did you ever mention? I mean,
not really. I mean, she said that she had to eat it. But, well, she said that regular food would make her sick. But she didn't go into any detail, and I don't know why my daughter really didn't push her on it, but my daughter was a really unusual person. She just took people for what they were, and she wouldn't have questioned that, because she would have, I know that she would have felt that would have been rude or pushy or something. And so she just accepted it, but she said it smelled kind of funny, and then as after quite a while, when her eyesight began to gradually come back just a little bit, it would come back sporadically. It does with diabetics, you know, sometimes.
Right.
And she said what she could see of it, it looked like spinach, old chopped up spinach that had been warmed up 3 or 4 times. It just looked awful, and that was... that was what it was that Rachel ate.
Wow.
And she was, my daughter was thankful that she didn't have to eat anything like that.
Now, she also had a strange voice.
Yes, she did. It was really mechanical and very, well, with no inflections. Like we speak with emotion in our voices, and we're up and down, sort of, but hers was very level and very mechanical, very measured, and she used no contractions. She didn't say didn't or can't or won't. It was all I will go or I cannot do this, and, you know, spoke in that manner. And right away, that was a red flag there.
All right, all these things are beginning to add up. And, of course, she had no history either, right?
No, because... Marissa would try to strike up a conversation with her, you know, how teenage girls do.
Sure.
And she would ask her about, what was your favorite song, for instance. And she had no favorite song. She hadn't listened to very much music. And then my daughter tried to talk about boys. Had she ever been on a date, or what did she like to do? And no, she had never been on a date, and she didn't know about dancing or movies or things like that. And she explained it away because she had been raised on this military base that was supposedly non-existent called Four Corners. And she didn't go off base very often to do anything except a couple of shopping trips with the nurses.
All right.
You know, and they dressed her, you know, in clothes that would sort of disguise her looks, but she didn't get involved in any of the normal teenage things.
You know, I was reading her story. It was so sad. I felt so bad for her.
It is a sad story. And, you know, I was reading while I was waiting to go on tonight with you, and I was reading a little book review, and how I had missed it before, I don't know. And someone had said, I hear Marissa died sometime in 1990. It's sad to get attached to a character and have these terrible things happen like they do. It's even worse when the characters in the book are all real people. It's just sad to get to know someone and then find out they were gone even before you ever knew them.
Wow.
And I don't know how I ever missed that before, but I just read it a few minutes ago, and that's sort of what you said. Yes. And it is sad that Rachel had to be terminated as she was. But I guess that she exceeded the requirements that the Humanization Project had imposed on her. And apparently there was no going back on them, on the emotions that she had been able to attain. But I've often thought, why couldn't they just send her back to where she came from? Why did they have to just kill her?
Well,
yeah, it is a sad thing, but that was the way it was. But it has affected a lot of the readers that way, too. They don't understand why these things are done, but they have to realize that our government does a lot of things like that, where the aliens are and hybrids are concerned sometimes.
Right.
And I guess we're not supposed to know the answers, or the reasons, I mean.
Right. Well, you're listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and our guest tonight is Helen Littrell, who is the author of Rachel's Eyes. This is really an amazing book. Now, you at one point had a chance to actually visit your daughter's apartment and meet Rachel?
Yes. Yes. I had stopped by. I had been hearing these strange things about Rachel, and I really wanted to get a look at her myself, because I knew that Marissa could see little glimpses here and there, but not really well, although she certainly understood what she was hearing and everything. So anyhow, I'd stopped by to hopefully see Rachel, and she wasn't there, so I stayed a few minutes and was getting ready to leave. And standing in the open doorway, and we heard footsteps coming up the stairs, and it turned out to be Rachel, who was coming in to get something that she had forgotten. And we had a really brief introduction there in the doorway, and I didn't notice too much because it all happened so fast then. I noticed that she had on this long-sleeved jumpsuit that she always wore, apparently, and a scarf tied around her head and wraparound sunglasses, but she went through so in front of me so fast that didn't pay any attention. But then when she came back out with whatever it was she had forgotten, she sort of tripped on a carpet or something, and she was going to fall. I could see that. And she was going to fall straight over, straight forward. She didn't try to catch herself, which was so unusual. And so I reached out and grabbed her arm, and because I didn't want her to fall on her face.
Right.
And as I did grab her arm, the sleeve of her jumpsuit slid up, and so I was holding on to the bare skin of her forearm, and it was really cool and spongy feeling, sort of like mushrooms.
Huh.
But, you know, it didn't feel real. Almost did, but not quite. And as I did that, as I grabbed her arm to catch her and stand her back up again, we were right nose to nose practically. And at that time, me jerking her back up had caused her sunglasses to slide down on her nose, and so her eyes were uncovered, and I'm looking eyeball to eyeball with her, at her, and her eyes were just huge. They sort of wrapped around onto the side of her temples, and they were all an avocado green, the color of the inside of an avocado, and they had vertical black slits for pupils. And I was just really in a panic, and I don't even know how many emotions I was going through, but probably quite a few. And for just a moment, I was frightened because I'd never seen anything like that. And I knew that, I just knew instantly she wasn't from here.
Wow.
But I got over that feeling of fear there in probably 2 or 3 seconds, and then I'm staring into her eyes. I couldn't seem to look away, and I could see from her eyes that she was more frightened than I was, and because she knew that I saw that she, you know, her disguise that she'd been carrying out all this time, well, she'd sort of lost it right then, and I knew her secret.
Wow.
Or part of it. I didn't certainly know the whole thing at that time. But she recovered and thanked me for catching her and went on her way. And I was just, I don't know, I was just faint feeling. I didn't know what to do. I told my daughter, I just have to sit down. I can't go home right this minute. I knew I should have, but I was in no condition to drive. So that was my meeting with Rachel.
Well, what did you think at that point? I mean, did you tell your daughter?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, she was right there, too, and she was aware of what happened, but she didn't see everything because of her vision being so low. But I told her, you know, immediately, as soon as I sat down, I told her that I had seen her eyes, and after hearing her speak and everything, I knew that she wasn't from here. And I did have that checked out, too, through a friend of mine who worked at the same military installation that I did. He was in security, and he had checked on Rachel when I first began hearing these stories that Rachel is not an ordinary person. I had this friend check out some background on the father, who was an Air Force colonel, and sort of led me to believe that she probably wasn't from here, but still I thought, well, there's a lot of funny things in the military. I worked for them for about 15 years, so I know that there's a lot of strange stuff. And at any rate, once I saw her and felt her skin and was eye to eye with her, I knew that what my friend had told me about the background was all true and that there was probably a whole lot more to it.
Wow. So what was the next thing that happened? I mean, okay, that's kind of, were you afraid for your daughter at all? I mean, Rachel mm-hmm. seems like a pretty harmless person, but this is kind of an unusual thing to happen.
Well, yes, it really was. And, you know, I never was afraid for my daughter or for my safety or anything, but, of course, I didn't live there, so that I wasn't in any possible danger. But by that time, they had become really close friends, even on the strange basis of the friendship where Rachel didn't really have much of any background, you know, as a typical teenager. But yet they were friends, and Rachel would help my daughter with her pick out her clothes to wear for the next day, because sometimes Marissa's vision was just totally gone, and she couldn't tell what she was getting out of the closet to wear, whether it would match or whatever. And she helped her like that, and she helped her cross the streets and go to school. You know, they had become good friends, but I wasn't afraid. But not very long after that face-to-face meeting. Well, of course, Rachel told her father about it, and she was afraid that I might make her leave the apartment because of what I had surmised. And so the father wanted to talk to me about Rachel's background and about his, too. And so he set up a meeting for, a few days, maybe a week later. And Rachel and my daughter and myself were there at the apartment with him. And he told me pretty much of his military background and certainly most of hers, as much as he knew. And this was, he began, we all sat there in the living room, and he started to talk to me and to my daughter about it. And it probably, the conversation may have been 10 minutes or so, something like that. And then all of a sudden, I felt this tremendous amount of information in my head, and it was all of this background of him and of her that's in the book. And I don't know how long I was there in the apartment, but not all that long, maybe 3/4 of an hour total. There is no way in this world that anyone could have told me all of that information in that length of time. But wow. There it all was. It was telepathic.
So that they transmitted it telepathically at that time?
Right, he did. Oh, and it was just like...
He did? The colonel?
Yes.
Wow.
It was like a huge file of information that somebody sends to you on a computer. It was there in my head.
Do you know how he did it?
He was looking at me. He was just looking really intently at me as he was talking the first part of his career in the military. And then after, as I say, probably 10 minutes, I don't think any more than that, all of a sudden, he's still looking at me, and I'm looking at him, and my daughter is still sitting there, and all this information is in my mind.
Wow.
I couldn't tell you how it was exactly, and I don't think that I was hypnotized. I don't think that, because I know what hypnosis is. I mean, I knew what it was then, too. And I'm sure it wasn't that. It was just a download. But he had learned to do that in his military training so that he would be able to deal with some of the visitors that came to Four Corners, the base that he was assigned to, some of the aliens. Because they didn't all speak English or any... Well, I guess some of them may have known a little, but his main... mode of conversation was telepathy.
That's amazing. So, I mean, did your daughter pick it up too?
Yes, she did. And, years after that, we could still do it, although she lived maybe, I guess, 300 miles away. We could do that back and forth. And then one of us would call the other, and we would give the other the answer to some little question so we could check each other out, you know. We would give the answer to a question we had asked, the other one had asked us.
Right.
Wanted to ask the other, I mean.
Right. So I guess
so we were pretty good at that.
It's like a muscle sort of that once you start using, I guess?
I think so, yeah.
Huh. How interesting. So what... What was the colonel's background, and what was the, how did, tell us where Marissa came from, and all of that?
Rachel, you mean.
Or, I'm sorry, Rachel.
Yeah. Well, he had gone into the military right out of high school, volunteered, and he was sent immediately, after his basic training, he was sent to specialized training so that he would be able to recognize different types of extraterrestrials and their different crafts. And he went through, I think it was about a 6 or 7 week course there back in the Midwest. And then he was transferred immediately after that, no furlough or anything. He was he went immediately to Four Corners, which is down in, let's see, that would be southwestern, or
New Mexico,
southwestern
and
Nevada, yeah, near Area 51.
Right.
But we didn't know about Area 51 at that time. You know, nobody talked about it, but that was the location near that, and it was, I'm not sure of the distance. Now, I think it's 50 or 75 miles north of Area 51 and Groom Lake, where that is now. But Four Corners was principally an underground base, had a few old ramshackle ranch buildings above ground, and just enough to make it look, you know, like it was pretty inconspicuous. But the labs and everything, the living quarters and everything was underground. And that was where he acquired Rachel.
Now, she came from a crashed UFO?
Yes, yes. And the other occupants who were thrown out and they were killed. And he was in charge, the colonel was in charge of the crew that was to go out and investigate all crashes. They didn't have that many of them, but when there were any, he and his crew were to pick up the survivors, and because he could communicate with them telepathically. And I don't know, I suppose some of his crew probably did too, but he was the main one that did it. But at any rate, this craft that crashed was beginning to burn, and he thought he could see some movement inside of it through a door or a hatch that was partially open. And so he went inside and found Rachel, and she was hurt just really in a minor way. I think she had a scratch on her arm. And so he pulled her out before the craft burned entirely and took her back to the little base dispensary that they had. And they fixed her up, you know, doctored up her scratch and found her some clean clothes to wear. And he just felt this immediate empathy with her. He was just really bonded to her for some reason he couldn't understand. And he knew she was a young individual, but he didn't know what age. But he could tell that, you know, she didn't look as old as the ones that were on the outside that had died. And he just, at any rate, even the nurses, they felt a special bond with her, and so they all decided they wanted to keep her there. They didn't want to have to send her back on the next craft that would come that she could return on. So the next morning, he contacted his headquarters, which was ATIC, which you can't find the correct meaning of that now. At that time, it stood for Aerospace Technical Information Command. And I know this because I researched this really carefully. And anyway, they gave the permission for him to keep her if he would agree to adopt her and raise her as a human child the best he could. And
the ETs gave permission?
No, ATIC did.
Oh.
It was the Air Force.
Oh, okay.
Command, Aerospace Technical Information Command.
Right.
And that was the agreement he had to make if he wanted to keep her. Otherwise, she would have to go back to the system that she came from, which he assumed was Zeta Reticuli. So anyway,
this is the information he told you in that one meeting?
All of this was downloaded. It's a wonder my head didn't explode. It really is. I look at it now, and I wasn't aware of all of the details, all the little tiny ones, but I was aware of the main ones for all of these years. But it wasn't until, I think it was 1995, that I started to undergo, or no, not 95, 98, that I started to undergo the regressions. And all of these little details came out, you know, just kind of supplement what I already knew. And I think I was as surprised as my therapist was.
Did the colonel say not to tell anybody?
No, he didn't, which was amazing because this stuff is way above top secret. I did, at that time, have a top secret clearance with the government. I had had it for several years, probably 8 or 9 years. But even so, it doesn't matter what your clearance is with information like that, you shouldn't be talking about it.
Well, it seems like on some level he must have wanted to get the information out.
I think he did. And my impression was that my daughter had been kind to his daughter, and I had been kind to her, too. And because I had visited at the apartment several times after that, and I had talked to her, and she and I had had some other things happen between us. And, I guess he felt that maybe I had earned the respect and I just should be able to know what her background was and his too. I don't know, but he was certainly taking an awful chance.
Wow. But you haven't really had any problems from telling the story, though, just what you mentioned, a little bit of phone tapping and stuff like that?
Mm-hmm. That's all. I have had certain files disappear off my computer, but we all lose files sometimes. But the strange thing was that the only ones I would miss or would lose would be the ones having to do with the book or even just personal conversations with June Steiner, who was the hypnotherapist.
Wow.
And what was even stranger, she had lost the files that she had saved on her computer of our conversations. So we lost them on both ends. She and I both did. She didn't lose anything else, and neither did I.
Well, that's strange. I wonder how you would account for that.
I don't know, but I think that was just another little bit of harassment to say, well, you know, we still know you're at it here, but we're not going to do anything more. We just have to do something to let you know. And that certainly would let a person know.
All right.
But otherwise, I haven't had any threats of harm, and I really don't anticipate any.
Well, that's good to hear, because I think this information does need to come out.
It's my feeling now that this is a good way for the government to get out of actually disclosing anything much themselves, is to let people like me and Bud and David Jacobs Jim Sparks, who wrote The Keepers. He's another one that's had experiences similar.
Right, I had him on the show, actually.
Right, and he's got a marvelous book there. But I think that's the government's way, maybe, of letting the information just kind of siphon out, and they won't do anything really bad to us. They'll let us know that they know it's coming out by these little harassments.
Right.
But physically harming us, really, if anything unusual happened to me or to Jim or to any of these other people that start talking about these things, it's not going to look very good for the government.
Right.
Really.
Well, it's just frustrating because, I mean, they have the craft. They were talking to these aliens. They have all this proof, and yet people are still being ridiculed.
Oh, I know. Well, I have people, too, that, all of a sudden they don't have a lot to do with me, and they don't call, and but that's all right. I understand. And I'm not angry at them. I do understand that if something hasn't happened to them, they just can't accept that it's happened to me, even though they know I'm still the same person. I'm not doing anything any different than I did before. But in their mind, it is different. And,
Well, it's threatening a little bit, I guess.
I suppose so. I just don't pay much attention to it. It's kind of offset by all of the people that have contacted me, either in person or on the phone, who have had experiences of one kind or another like this maybe all their lives, and they haven't been able to talk about it. They've been really frightened.
Oh, really? You've heard from other people who've had similar experiences.
Right. Well, not especially, well, not quite like having Rachel face to face, but, you know, they've been abducted, and they just have been so afraid to talk about it. They're just plain fearful, period.
Wow.
But then there's all of these repercussions that can take place, too. They could lose their job. Their families will have nothing to do with them.
It's terrible.
Different kinds of things that, you know, the things that can happen.
Oh, sure, yeah. I'm actually familiar with it. So what were some of the other experiences that you had with Rachel?
Well, there was one time, again, I went to the apartment to visit, and my daughter wasn't there, so I thought, well, I would wait a little bit. And Rachel was there, and she just kept saying, "I wish you could be my mother."
Oh.
And I kept saying, "Well, I can't be your mother, but I can be your friend. I am your friend." But she would repeat it, and a couple times she did. And then finally, she and I said the same thing, too. And then finally she said, "Well, I'm going to take you, I want to show you where I come from." And I don't remember that I said anything, because we were standing in the kitchen, and I was standing with my back to an old kitchen table, those old white-topped porcelain tables. And I was standing there with my hands behind me on the table, and she was standing sort of in front of me, and as she was talking, she was just staring into my eyes. And the next thing I remember was that I was on the outside of a large room. I think that I was probably on a ship. I'm not sure, but I think I must have had to have been. But at any rate, I was on the outside of this oval-shaped room, and everything was all white, and there was rows of windows all the way around the room. The windows started about waist high and went up to the ceiling. And I'm on the outside, and Rachel's on the inside, and she said, "Come on inside." And I said, "I can't. There isn't any door." She said, "You don't need one. You just put your hand on the window, put one hand on the window, and I'll put on the outside, and I'll put mine on the inside right at your hand, and you can come through." So I did that, and I found myself going through the window.
Wow.
And I still remember that feeling, a real elongated, wavy, kind of nauseous feeling, just kind of funny. And then I was on the inside, and I was okay. And then we were...
Now, was this like a physical experience or an out-of-body experience, or do you know?
I don't know. I think it was physical, but it may have been out of body, but I don't do out of body experiences that I know of. You know, I'm not sure about that. I've always thought it was a physical experience, but
okay.
At any rate, we were in this inner room, and aligning the walls of this room were three rows of tanks, and there was maybe, well, I don't know how many of them there were total, because they were all around the room, three high. But inside these tanks was sort of a yellow-greenish-looking liquid, and inside were floating all different stages of fetuses. And they were all kind of deformed-looking and just awful. I was just horrified. And she said something like that, "We need you to help take care of these." And I said, "I can't take care of these things." And I called them things. And she was really angry. And that was the only time I saw her display any emotion, but she was very angry.
Wow.
And I said, "I can't. I cannot take care of these things." And she said, "Well, that's all right. We will give you another job." and you will be an educator. And I said, I have no credentials. I still remember saying that, and I thought afterwards, oh, how silly, you know, this whole conversation was just crazy. And she said, that is not the kind of educator I mean. You will tell people about this. And so I guess I am an educator of sorts. I guess because I am telling this story.
Absolutely, yeah.
But when I saw those horrid-looking fetuses, they were just all different anomalies there, just all kind of defects, and
exactly,
they would never be right.
That's exactly what another lady told me who lives not far from where I live here in California.
Mm.
Exactly the same thing, and they wanted her to hold the babies and to love them and to nurture them. And
that's what she wanted me to do. I couldn't. I don't know what I would have done if I had been forced to stay there. I suppose I would have had to. I wouldn't have had any choice. But I did. I did talk my way out of it. But that was frightening. That was the only experience I had with her that truly, truly turned me off. There was one during one of the regressions that made me a little faint-hearted, too, because Dr. Steiner asked me the first time that I saw Rachel, well, what did she look like? And so I started to, that was before I had the face-to-face meeting. This was at the time I saw her in the doorway when she first came through, first came back to the apartment. And I described her hands, and I described that she had four fingers, and that didn't bother me. But then I could see that she had no fingernails, and that
wow,
really disturbed me. And I'm not exactly sure, you know, why that happened either, but that did disturb me to see that. But I was very thankful. Well, then after we got it settled what sort of a job I was going to be doing, I was going to educate, I suddenly found myself back in the kitchen with my still standing with my back to the table and my hands behind me on the table. And I remember that sensation because it was a really hot day in the early spring, and you know how hot it can get in up in Northern California. And that porcelain felt really cool on my hand. But how I got back there, I don't know.
Wow. Well, they have those capabilities.
They do. And you asked whether it may have been out of body. I honestly don't know. I have wondered about that.
Well, what happened immediately afterwards? Was Rachel still looking at you?
Yes. She was still standing there where she had been, beside the refrigerator and beside her jugs of water where they were liquid, where they were all lined up there. And still looking at me, and my daughter still hadn't come home. So I said, well, I guess, you know, something to the effect of, I guess I better leave now, which was a good thing. I think I'd had enough for that afternoon.
Right.
But as far as I know, she never did anything like that to my daughter, you know, took her on any of those trips like that.
Well, you had kind of a special relationship, it sounds like.
I think I did. And
which is amazing. I mean, that's so amazing when you think about it.
There's just so much more to that story, and I keep, sometimes I get a flashback yet, but that clarifies little things that didn't have complete answers before.
Right. So how did it all end? You mentioned that Rachel.
Oh, yeah. Well, one day my daughter came home from classes for lunch, and normally Rachel would be there because she usually just had afternoon classes. But this day, there was no sign of her, and although still my daughter couldn't see very well, she could tell that there was no one there, and she looked in the Rachel's bedroom, and there was nothing there but just the bare bed and the dresser, which was there to begin with. And she called her, and no answer. And so then she looked at the dresser, at the mirror on the dresser, and there was a note that was taped to it. And so she took it off, and she sat down on the bed, and she read it. And it said something to the effect that she hated to leave like that, but she was leaving her a gift to remember her by. And it was signed, Love, Rachel. And it took her several minutes to realize that she had read that note without the use of her really heavy-powered magnifying glass, and that the gift that Rachel had left was pretty obviously the gift of much improved sight all of a sudden.
It's amazing.
It wasn't a total return, but it was much improved. And that was noticed by her brother and some other people that I interviewed.
Wow, and that was the last contact?
That was the last contact, and she called me at work, and I again called my friend in security and asked him if he could find out anything about the colonel's whereabouts, and maybe he would know where Rachel had gone. And so he made a phone call and called me right back, and it was like the colonel had never existed. All of his files had disappeared. And the thing was, my friend knew they had been there before because he had checked them out and told me some of the background of the colonel that was verified when the colonel gave me this big download of information.
Right.
So the colonel was gone, Rachel had disappeared, and we call, and certainly the first thing that my daughter had done was call the school. And mysteriously, all her records had disappeared from there, too.
Wow.
And they had disappeared all during our investigation. And another mysterious thing happened just before the book went to publication, because we didn't have anything. We had no proof. I mean, nothing in black and white. And mysteriously, I got in the mail a letter verifying that Rachel had indeed been enrolled in school during the time that was in question, and that she had taken a sudden leave of absence, and it was signed by the dean of students there.
Wow.
And it was on embossed letterhead, you know, it was official.
Was that her real name that she used, Rachel?
Mm-hmm, yes.
Wow. No last name?
Oh, yes. Rachel Nadine.
Uh-huh.
But up until that time, the school wouldn't tell anything either. They said they had no information. And then when I had given up, after several attempts in by telephone and mail and, you know, however I could, I thought it was just a dead end. And then after maybe several months, probably 4 or 5 months of no contact with the school, here comes this letter. Everything was very strange about this case.
It sounds amazing. I mean, the book is amazing. It's really a groundbreaking book. I think there's really no book I can think of, and I've got all of them pretty much like it.
Could I tell them how to order it?
Yeah, please.
Okay, you can get this at fifthworld.com, and that's 5th.com, 5thworld.com, or Amazon.com, or you can telephone for it, and that is 1-800-366-0264.
Okay, and that's during business hours, right?
Yes, it is, and that is Eastern Time, too.
Okay, so the website is Fifth World, that's 5th.
Right, and also the spelling on Rachel is kind of unusual, too. That's R-A-E. C-H-E-L'S.
Yes, I actually noticed that.
that is confusing to a lot of people.
Okay. You can order it. There's an email here, orders@fifthworld.com, and the number again is 1-800-366-0264.
That's right.
I hope everyone out there listening really does go out there and buy this book because, it's an emotional story. It's a groundbreaking story, and it's It's just amazing.
Oh, thank you.
It's really, really a well-written and very amazing story. And I'm so, so honored and happy that you went forth and wrote it and told your story.
Well, I am now, too. Immediately after it came out, I thought I was probably going to be sorry I ever did that. And that didn't turn out to be the case at all. I've just been rewarded so much from the reader response. I'm just so happy about that.
Well, it's great to hear. Well, that's pretty much our show. I want to thank you, Helen, for coming on, and you've been an amazing guest.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me, Preston.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, you've been listening to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett. Our guest tonight has been Helen Littrell, the author of Rachel's Eyes. Now, if you want to get this book, you can order it. I've got the number again here. I'll give it to you. It's 1-800-366-0264. Please call only during business hours, and it's also available on the website fifthworld.com or on amazon.com. And please go out there and buy the book. It's amazing. I promise you won't be disappointed. Next week, our guest is Anne Druffel, author of Firestorm, The Search for James McDonald, and The Fight for UFO Science, and several other books. So I hope you can all join us next week. Until then, have a good evening.